power to actually try to come up with very complicated, or deal with very complicated, even at the algebraic level, computations. And then a great example in this building is Pedro Vieira, who has made great contributions that essentially have been realized thanks to Exploding Mathematica and his research. As far as simulations is concerned, okay, typically one goes after a problem that may have been defined before. Okay, the kind of the prototypical example is that of binary black holes. I mean, Einstein already very, very early on tried to go after a two-body problem, but that's a problem that was completely open till the year 2005 with Franz Pretorius, who is going to be teaching the last week, essentially cracked the problem for the first time thanks to numerical simulations. But the virtue of numerical simulations is not just solving the problem, but it's opening new questions once you have this, the problem solved. You may discover that the system behaves in some ways that you didn't expect, and that actually poses now new questions that may be even more interesting than the ones you set up to resolve to try to tackle from there on. So I'll just show you one example, actually two. So this is something we did some years ago with Franz Pretorius, and it was trying to answer the questions, what happened with some family of unstable black holes in higher dimensions. These are a very particular class of black holes in 5D called black strings, where essentially you have a Schwarzschild black hole across a circle. And Ruth Gregory and Ray LaFlamme, both of whom you, I'm sure, well, at least Ruth, you have met, just show that through linearized analysis, the event horizon, or the space-time would be unstable. And this, what it's showing is what the, essentially the event horizon is doing. And they were able to do this linearized approximation, just take the basic solution, the background of an unstable, of stable, unperturbed black string, you introduce a little bit of a perturbation, and you solve the linearized equations motions to a basic degree that basically tells you where you're going to have possibly unstable modes. They actually pointed out that as opposed to the four-dimensional case in 5D, black holes could, depending on the configuration you choose, have unstable modes. But of course, they couldn't go and dig out what the final answer would be, because from there on, once something begins to depart exponentially fast from your basic solution, the perturbation method doesn't work anymore once the perturbations get to be of order one. So a numerical study that we did actually points out that, I mean, the perturbations will drive the horizon to have a very, very complicated structure, actually end up showing the solution is self-similar, a self-similar cascade to a fractal-like structure. And then some pieces of the event horizon would essentially shrink to zero size, revealing a naked singularity. So now the consequences of these are very profound in the concept of large extra-dimensional scenarios. We could have a series of unstable black holes, and some of those may actually produce unstable, or may have unstable configurations that may produce at the end of the day a naked singularity, and therefore quantum gravity will have to come and solve a situation that was generically generically arise in this context. Another example is the following. And later on, I'll show you some other examples, but here involves someone who is sitting in the audience, Federico. This is in the context of ADS-CFT, where what he's trying to look at is what the behavior of fluids, the dual fluid of a curved rotating black hole is in the boundary. In the boundary, that fluid is just a rigidly rotating configuration of a very particular type of fluid, but you perturb it a little bit, and the intuition was that if the dual is a black hole, and our intuition of black holes is that you perturb it a little bit, and then they radiate away. In this case, this is a black hole that is hopefully, or is believed to be stable. You think that you perturb it a little bit and it will just decay away. But a dual, on the dual description, you go and study what happens on the fluid side of things at the boundary, and just a very small perturbation generates all this messy structure, which is just due to the fact that the system is governed to the first order by Navier-Stokes, and these equations can lead to turbulence, and that's precisely what's being shown here. Moreover, you see that these small structures begin to kind of join together and form much larger structures, and this is a testament of the fact that we're dealing with a fluid dynamics in 2 plus 1. So we're imagining that the black hole, the Kerr black hole in ADS is a 3 plus 1 black hole. The boundary theory is a 2 plus 1 boundary theory. And fluids in two dimensions plus time actually do this. They generate a small structure, ends up joining and forming large structures, and this is why we have weather patterns. Our weather, the atmosphere, is governed by a weather pattern that is essentially governed by two-dimensional equations, because the size of the sphere is much larger than the thickness of the atmosphere, so it's essentially a two-dimensional problem. And these hurricanes that grow to very large sizes are just a consequence of this. However, if you were to do the same simulation in three dimensions, 3 plus 1, the structures will go in the opposite direction. They want to form smaller and smaller structure. So maybe it's just it's hinting at possible interesting physics going on the gravity side that we have yet to understand yet or even uncover. So sometimes you write a simulation thinking you're going to get the particular behavior, and then the equations tell you better that something else is indeed the behavior of the system. So let's try to pick up where we left yesterday. And discuss this problem in more detail. So this is, look at this. Yeah, so let me just pick up from here. Can you see that? Okay. Oh. So we set ourselves to work with these equations. We're going to put boundary conditions in between at 0 and at 1. That's the domain of our computational domain. We're going to discuss things in a slightly different way because of clarity in the presentation. Let us introduce two new variables. We're going to introduce the variable capital phi. Which is just a spatial derivative of the little phi, and capital pi, which is the time derivative of the little phi. With that, we can rewrite the system of equations in this way. So you take the initial equation. This is what we're doing. We're taking this equation, which having defined pi as pi comma t, this is pi comma t, having defined capital phi as phi comma x, this is capital phi comma x, and then if we ask the question, what is this one, what is the time derivative of this one, it is the time derivative of that one, we commute derivatives, and then we have pi comma x. So the equations of motions turn out to be that one. The variable, the little phi, once we have solved for capital pi and capital phi, if we want to know what the solution for little phi is, we just iterate this other equation. And this is a very simple equation. So for the all intents purposes in our discussion, we're going to ignore this little phi from now on. It's because we're slowly building towards studying, say, Einstein-Klein-Gordon, where the energy from the scalar field actually is contained in the variables pi and capital phi. And so for all internal purposes, what the value of little phi is irrelevant. But we can very straightforwardly obtain it if we desire to do so. So we're going to be discussing the 1D wave equation in first order form, because this is what we have done. By doing so, we have now two first order equations, this one and that one. Now the variables are changed, right? So we have the right hand side of phi, I have phi, and the right hand side of phi, I have pi. But it doesn't matter, they're all first order in time, first order in space. And we're going to be discussing everything at the same time. So we want to provide boundary conditions. So whenever we solve any problem, we want to specify the most complete mathematical way first, and then only then start a numerical analysis. So we wrote our equations. We're going to provide particular boundary initial data. And for simplicity, we're going to assume these Gaussian profiles that we discussed yesterday, or anything that we care. But the last piece of information that we need to give, because we're essentially given an initial boundary value problem, is to provide boundary conditions. So boundary conditions are, well, just a piece of physics, so we're dealing with a domain that goes from, say, 0 to 1. If we're interested in very, very long evolutions, so we want to go all the way here, and we want to find what the solution is there, you can imagine that for long enough intervals, ultimately what's going to be governing the physics is precisely the boundary conditions, not necessarily the initial conditions. We can have a lot more area if you want along the size of this rectangle than we had initially. So we have to be very careful in what type of boundary conditions we consider, which should be either physical or we need to do something with our treatment to make sure they don't negatively influence the dynamics we're obtaining. So let's assume the following problem. What we're trying to do is model in a finite computational domain the problem that will be equivalent to one where the boundaries are not there. For this particular case, it's actually quite simple to think of reasonable boundary conditions, and the ones we're going to be thinking about are those that have a name of have been called Sommerfeld boundary conditions. Essentially, it says we have a piece of the solution that is propagating to the left, and it's about to hit the boundary. We're just going to let it go as if that boundary weren't there. And similarly on the other boundary. So what we're saying is, suppose we're at the left boundary. What we're going to be trying to impose is that the solution of the function phi, capital phi, at t and x, is essentially the same as that is given by phi of x plus t. So they say whatever gets to that boundary is actually propagating towards the left boundary, and similar to pi. So we can use that explicitly to say, okay, if this is the functional form of the solutions we're obtaining, and these relationships have to be satisfied. The time derivative of the function phi is equal to the space derivative of the function phi, and the same thing with pi. Next week, we're going to have a very rigorous or a rigorous way of determining these boundary conditions. At the moment, we're just thinking kind of at the form of the hand-waving physical intuition level and trying to impose these things this way. Next week, we'll see how mathematically we can make sense in rigorous terms everything we're saying now. We do the same thing at the right boundary, except at the right boundary, we would have, if something is going to hit the right boundary, it should be propagating for the case of our equations that we know have propagation speeds of equal to 1, then we expect the functional dependence to be like x minus t and x for both phi and pi. And so, again, if you now take time derivative space derivatives, you're related by a minus sign. So this afternoon, when we actually look at the first kind of lab homework that we have, we're actually going to be discussing this problem in particular, and we can then go and modify boundary conditions as we wish and see how things change. So now that we have our problem completely specified, say from the point of view or from the formal point of view, we need to say how we're going to discretize the problem, as we discussed yesterday. So we need a recipe of how to go forward in the future, to the future, and how to discretize things in space. Rather than using the method that we discussed yesterday, the leapfrog method that we discussed later on, one problem that approach has, we're going to introduce a different one, which is called, is known as the Kranz-Nicholson method. Which you'll see how it comes about. We're going to try to center our problem as much as we can. Notice that as opposed to yesterday, when we were looking at the second order wave equation, now that having introduced new variables and redefined the problem in terms of two variables, we only see first order time derivatives, also first order space derivative. But the fact that we're seeing only first order time derivatives allows us to think that we can discretize the problem based on only two time levels. So let me imagine I have the solution up to that level. Let me call it level n. We can be interested in obtaining the solution at n plus 1. And because I only have just one time derivative in the problem, I can imagine that I'm centering everything at the level n plus 1/2, right? With these two. This is the unknown solution that we're trying to find. But formally, the solution here, once we have it, minus the solution there, the derivative will give us the derivative, the solution here minus the solution there divided by delta t will give us a second order approximation to the solution right in the middle. This is central derivative. Similarly, we can do the same thing with points in space. And so we're going to do we're going to try to get a second order approximation to the equations that only involve two time levels. And this is precisely what this method achieves. So this is going to be kind of our basic cell. We're going to take, remember, we need two, if we're trying to obtain the derivative, the first derivative to second order at the point j, say at this level, we're going to take the value here minus the value there divided by this spacing in between these two points. But that gives us the second derivative, the first derivative to second order approximation here, but we're trying to center everything there. So what we're going to do is we're going to center things at that point. The time derivative will be the difference of these two guys, but whenever we see a second, whenever we see a spacing derivative, we're going to have to average this level and that level, and as a result, we're going to end up with something that looks to be implicit rather than explicit. So let me just quickly go through the basic algorithm. For the sake of the argument, we're just going to take one of the equations because the other one is the same, just reversing pi and phi. So this is what I was just saying. If we take the difference of the value of phi at the level n plus 1 minus the value of phi at the level n, and we divide by delta t, we can make sense of that rigorously as being the time derivative evaluated at that middle point, which is a virtual point, plus some error terms. And the leading part of the error term goes like the third time derivatives of the function phi multiplied by delta t squared. To discretize the space part, well, at the level n, we can take, this is the expression we had yesterday for the space derivative, which gives us a second order approximation at the level n at the point j. So we're good with respect to the time derivative. This time derivative is centered at the point j, as far as space is concerned, but as far as time is concerned, it's at the level n plus a half. So this is not good enough for a second order approximation because it's only at level n. So we need to do something else. So what we're going to do is just add to this an R operator, if you want, which is just the average in between two time levels, the operator mu, normally acting on the on unj is just the average of this, the level n and the level n plus 1 at that very same point. So it's very easy to show, and I leave that as an exercise, that if you do apply that operator to this derivative operator, the discrete operator, you actually produce the derivative, the spatial derivative of phi, precisely what we want at the level j, at j in the space direction, and n plus 1, much plus a half at the time direction. So we can now combine that, which is centered at that point, n plus a half j, with this, and we have now a formal second order approximation to our equation. The problem now is that we know we see n plus 1 in the left-hand side, but we also have n plus 1 in the right-hand side. So as opposed to the case we discussed yesterday, when we had n plus 1, and we could put everything else in the right-hand side, and everything in the right-hand side would be known. In this case, there are pieces that are unknown, and we have to solve that. So this is how now the full expression would be, and this is what it was saying. There is the n plus 1 shows both in the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And this, of course, is just for our particular case. In general, if we have any system of equations, which we're going to call, say, encoded in a vector u, which in our case could be both phi and pi. So I can always say, suppose I have our equation pi comma t equal phi comma x, phi comma t equal pi comma x. It's if I define the vector u to be pi, then I can always formally say that we have an equation u comma t equal to some operator acting on the vector u. And we'll discuss a lot more of this as we go along. So formally, we can always say that the Kragh-Nicholson scheme can be applied to any arbitrary number of first-order equations in the following way. The time derivative is just the time derivative center. And the right-hand side is the average of whatever operator defines the right-hand side acting on n plus 1 on n. And as long as we discretize the operator to the appropriate order, this will be a second order approximation. And by appropriate order, I mean whatever discretization we have for L, if we want this to be second order, it better be at least second order or higher. So we'll discuss later on in a bit how we treat that problem. Now we have to say, well, we need to still incorporate our boundary conditions. So this is what we want to impose at the boundary. At all interior points, we weren't going to use that RS system. But at a boundary, we want to do something else. And one problem we encounter once we have the boundary is that if I try to incorporate the calculated derivative there, I don't have a point to the left. Or if I try to compute the derivative there, I don't have a point to the right. And so for that, what we do is we skew the derivative operators by using something that are known as forward or backward difference and approximations. And I leave it as an exercise, again, just using the Taylor approximation on these points. You can see that if you write the derivative in this way, notice that now this is called the forward derivative, because it only involves, even the point j, it involves the points to the right of j, or this one, which is the backward derivative, where if you have j, it only involves points to the left of j. So this would be the expression we would use at the left boundary. And this R one would be the expression we use at the right boundary. We would use this to write the right-hand side, right? So we want to impose this expression, say for phi, at the left boundary, and this one at the right boundary. And when we need to compute the space derivative, we encounter the problem that we don't have points to the left or to the right, and we're going to use this. It is important to stress here that even though one can always use sideways derivative this way, it's not necessarily the case that once we put that in the boundary conditions, we're going to have something that is stable. In order for it to be stable, we need to make sure that the information is propagated in the right way and we're accounting for it appropriately. And this is something we'll discuss more as we go along. First, I need to discuss the concept of stability, and then we'll see why some choices might be completely wrong. But for these cases, everything is good. OK, so this is our scheme. This is what the basic code that you have for starting the first lab exercise, or the first part of the lab exercise. When you download the information that is in the web page, you're going to have a code that actually incorporates this. And I'll show you, once we go to the lab, I'll walk you through this example so that you know precisely what's going on. And this is where this RMPL software comes very handy, because essentially this is what you write in a simple interface file. And once you type a command, the full code will be automatically generated for you. And by that I mean the code that has all the memory allocated to keep track of what the solution is at any given time, all the interface supervision, the output that you want, all the parameter files to the parameters that you need and the subroutines that you need to incorporate whatever initial condition you specified, everything is built in automatically. So we're going to start this, and for simplicity, we're going to define the initial data in this particular way. We'll give some initial for phi and some initial data for pi. And we can convince ourselves very easily that depending on what the value of this sigma is, so we're notice that we're saying pi is equal to phi multiplied by a parameter. And depending on the value of the parameter, we're going to end up defining data that moves either solely to the left, solely to the right, or has equal amount of information going from left to right. OK, so now I want to discuss something else. So this is kind of was a prelude of what we'll discuss this afternoon. But let's say you go, you write a code, you're getting a solution. Hopefully, it's not blowing up. You want to know that things are behaving as you expected. And you want to be able to quantify how good your solution is. So that's what we're going to now discuss some more. So in general, let's say this is the kind of problem we're solving. Some operator. This operator could be, say, the box equation, the box operator operating on a set of unknown functions which we're trying to solve. equal perhaps to some sources that you put by hand. We're now going to discuss this problem in general at the formal level and discuss all the possible nuances that may come into play in trying to understand where the solution is the correct one. So again, a fiducial example would be to assume, to think that L is the box operator up in the new, and this is the problem that we first discussed, but this is completely general. The discussion we're going to have now is valid for any problem that the only assumption we're going to make is that we're going to be using finite differences, but that actually small variations of these essentially apply to any possible other techniques. Okay, so that's the problem we want to solve, but that's not the problem we actually solve. We all solve a different problem because we solve a discrete version of L. We have perhaps a discrete version of the source, or at least a round of approximation or approximation to round of error of whatever source we want. And we're going to obtain a function u, which is the discrete value for our solution. So the solution we actually, the problem we're actually solving is this one. And we're going to use an upper index h to denote that that's a discrete version of our analytical problem. So we're going to define a few notions. First, we're going to define the concept of residual. And the residual will be essentially whatever it is when we take L, we apply it to U, the discrete version of L, the discrete version of U, minus the discrete version of H. Of course, if we're solving that problem exactly, this would be zero. But routinely, and especially in the case of Clark-Nicholson, we just notice, or we just mentioned that this L, once we write it, it involves, or when L applied to U, it involves several levels. Inverting that problem, or tying the left-hand side and the right-hand side that have the same unknowns, typically might be very expensive. So in the end, you actually might not be solving precisely this system, but you're solving a system to which approximates that other one. And so we're going to allow for that. And so the difference between the operator L, the discrete version of the operator L, the function that we're obtaining at any given point, we may end up coming to iterate, minus whatever source, that difference will be something we call the residual. Of course, if it is zero, we're solving exactly the approximate problem that we defined. If it's non-zero, we're solving it to some residual level. And our goal would be to reduce this number as much as we can to ensure, or at least to convince ourselves, that this is a good approximation to the original problem that we wanted to solve, which in turn better be a good approximation to the continuous problem that we're interested in. One of the most important things that we have at our disposal is something called the truncation error. Even though we typically will not be able to compute it, we're going to be able to estimate it. And it's related to the residual, but it's in the following form. Suppose we have a discrete operator L. Again, if we have derivatives, we have the values of the derivatives of the functions at 2 points divided by the distance, etc. F is the discrete version of whatever source we have, and U is the exact analytical solution. So if someone hands out to us the exact analytical solution, we can always stick it in our discrete approximation to the operator and whatever source, and that generically would be different from zero because we don't have the exact derivative here, we have an approximation to that. So whatever remains is what is going to tell us the truncation error. And we're going to be especially interested in how this truncation error changes when we change the discretization length. And you'll see how, even though we may not know U, it helps to formally think of this way because this is going to be something we're going to use to test how your code is working. Okay, so the main thing whenever we have a numerical code, the main question we want to answer every time is the convergence properties of our code. That is, if we have solved a problem, we want to know whether as we decrease the size of our grid or increase the resolution of our grid, U tends to the analytical solution. Again, of course, we not necessarily know what U is, but we can always check if the trend is satisfied, if U is converging to a given solution by decreasing H. The idea here is that we can always do sufficient experiments to convince ourselves and everyone else that this is indeed happening. And you'll see this in the examples we do in the labs. There's the concept of consistency. And consistency has to do with this truncation error. We better be able to prove that if we decrease H to zero, the truncation error goes to zero. So essentially, consistency tells, convergence tells us that the solution we're obtaining is tending to a unique solution at the end of the day when H goes to zero. Consistency is a statement that the solution we're getting is indeed the solution to the problem we solve. It's very easy to introduce bugs, say this is a problem we're trying to solve. Remember this u, x, our approximation would be u and uj plus 1 minus uj minus 1 divided by 2 delta x, say for a second order approximation. And anyone can forget, including that 2, say you just introduce a bug. So in reality, if I forget these 2, the problem I'm actually solving is not that one, but it's this one. Right? If I want to solve that problem, and when I type the derivative operator, I forget these 2, that would be equivalent to being solving this problem. Right? So if I now forgot that, I think I'm writing this problem, I look at the solution, the solution I will obtain will be convergent. Do you see this? So the solution will be convergent. We check convergence in our code, and indeed we're going to have as we decrease the size or the distance between 2 points, we'll see our solution converging to a given unique solution. But if we try to check for consistency, we're going to see that our truncation error will not be going to zero. And I'll tell you how one goes on about trying to check for consistency. Of course, this is what one usually ignores, because one thinks that one never makes a mistake. You're trying to write your code, you try to be as careful as you want, as you can, and you say at the end of the day, I'm done. And typically people only check for convergence, but every now and then there are surprises just because bugs are easily introduced, especially in complicated code. Another useful concept is the order of the finite difference approximation that basically says, we're gonna say our code, our solution converges to the right one to order P, if this is satisfied. That as we decrease our grid size, we see the solutions decreasing with a given order. And that, as I said, is a useful test because you always have control on the order of the scheme that you're gonna try to use. And it better be that if you put everything, say, to order n, that the solution you get obtain is also order n at least. If not, that may be a sign that something went wrong in the implementation. And the other thing we're going to define is the solution error, again, which is that the difference between the analytical solution, or the continuous solution, and the numerical solution, which again, generically, we don't know how this is, but it helps to think about this because we're going to be manipulating things in a particular way to actually give us the right information on how the error is behaving. So this is what I said before. It's common to assume that we see the truncation error is behaving with some given power, that the solution error will also be decaying with the same power. But it's something we need to investigate. Again, an example would be that bug there. If we forget the factor of 2, we're going to be seeing the convergence, but when we come to the solution, we're going to be getting the wrong solution. So the question for us is how to make sure that all these things are satisfied. So as I said before, we're mainly going to be discussing things that relate to the finite difference approximation, but many of these concepts apply almost the same way to all cases, except that some particular techniques don't have equispacings or treat things in a different way depending on where one is in the solution. And so not everything translates directly, but they are analogs for all the different numerical techniques. So let us discuss one particular case which can be solved in closed form, and not to kind of argue that this is something we can do or we should do at all in all cases, because we actually can't. But it will tell us a little bit of how we should be thinking about errors in our solutions. So let me simplify the problem. Let's consider again that one, u, t equal a, u, x. Parenthetical side story, this guy, Heinz Otto Kreis, who I said yesterday is one of the fathers of numerical analysis. Basically, he's from Sweden, and he owns a little island in Sweden. The guy is really famous. He has many very interesting books. He's been hired all around. So in the 50s, he was hired by the U.S. National Weather, whatever, something or other office to try to see how one should go about discretizing the weather equation, the equation determining weather, to see, be able to predict catastrophes and weather patterns. And he, in all his cases, he's just solving this equation. Every theory he has is based on that, because as we'll discuss next week, pretty much all hyperbolic equations can be mapped into this. So this joke is that that guy owns a little piece of Sweden just by solving that equation. And he's an amazing guy. Anyway, so with that, let's assume that we're going to, for simplicity, we don't want to think about periodic boundaries, so we're going to assume periodic boundary conditions. We're solving this problem on a circle. So our space is just a circle, so we can always only go around it. So formally, we're going to assume it has length 1, but it's periodic. So we identify x equals 0 to x equals 1, so we go around. The solution to this equation with a being constant is totally trivial. Is whatever initial pattern we have, just translate it with the right speed. So it's whatever initial solution have. If we have an initial configuration u0, the solution at any time, at any point, is just the initial pattern translated appropriately and circumscribed in the regime 0 to 1, or in the domain 0 to 1. So now what we're going to do is just try to analyze what the error of this solution is, given that we can actually compute what the solution is trivially, as we just discussed. So for simplicity, we're going to use the leapfrog method. So the space derivatives, we're going to treat them like this. Time derivatives, we're going to treat them like that. And the reason we're doing this is because it's the simplest, cleanest one. We could be using this for the argument also, the Kramer-Nicholson method that we just discussed. But let's keep this one, which is the simplest. Also, as we discussed, we're going to imagine that the space points are separated by a distance h, and we take delta t to be proportional to delta x with some parameter lambda. And we'll discuss later on why we want to know about this, given that we want to discuss stability properties. So now we're going to go backwards in some way. So we started with a continuum problem, and we discussed how to go to a discrete problem. Now we want to analyze the discrete problem as being possibly approximated by a continuous solution. But by that I mean we're going to use this, but it's something, an observation that Lacks introduced, which says if you have a solution, a numerical solution, so I'm going to still use this superindex h, which you have obtained, which is a solution of a continuous problem, then this solution should be expressible in terms of, okay, so this is the analytical solution, of course, that's what we're trying to obtain. Plus, I think I have another notation there, but let me just use this one here. We're saying the discrete solution UH that has values at discrete points can be arbitrarily well approximated by this analytical solution that generically we don't know. And the errors are encoded in things that goes like the separation to different powers. And if we have a purely centered different scheme, everything is centered, they will go with even powers of h. But they are multiplied by other functions. But the point is that all these functions are continuous. U, g, f, and so on. Everything multiplies at the discrete level. The discrete separation to some power is a continuous function. And we're going to use that to analyze the behavior of this discrete solution. So this is what we're saying here. We're seeing the solution of the finite difference approximation as approximated by the continuum problem. So this is what we're going to use, again, kind of reverse engineering what we discussed before, we notice that the discrete version of the space derivative is an approximation to the continuous derivative plus extra pieces, and the extra pieces we can always compute straightforwardly and come up with things that are continuous. So this is the partial derivative, then the error went like 1 over 6 h squared times the third derivative partial again, and so on, continuous derivative, and same thing with time. So we can think of three different problems. This is our original problem, the continuous operator multiplying or acting on the continuous solution that we're trying to obtain, and this minus the source equal to 0. That's given by this problem in our particular case. The fully discrete problem is the fully discrete operator under acting on the fully discrete value solution u minus the discrete source, and that would be equivalent to this problem, the discrete derivative minus the factor of the discrete space derivative or acting on the discrete function u equal to 0. This is the problem that we solved. So now we're going to try to reinterpret this in a slightly different form. And this is the following. So suppose where we are able to put the analytical solution in here, that will not give us 0. That will be equal to some error. That's how the th shows up. And that's equal to this. And this is how we're defining. But now, if I use these expressions, because notice what we have here, the continuous function. So rather than using the discrete derivatives, I want to replace the discrete derivatives in terms of everything that is continuous. So this is going to be equal to that, right? Because the first orders, when they act on u, are satisfying this first problem. And so that knocks off that piece. And we only are left with this and higher order terms. So now we're going to see what we get as a result. So this is what I said before, except now this with different notations. We're seeing the discrete solution as approximated by continuous functions multiplied by the separation to some given power. And this is known as the Richardson expansion. And this is what I mentioned. If we weren't doing finite differences, we might have to worry about things that come at different orders. But in general, we're going to think for this case is that we're all centered. So this, and for simplicity, let's assume that we don't have any driving source. We're just thinking about that problem. So let's see what this happens when we now replace everything, both L and U, by the ansatz. So we're going to replace UH by this, and we will replace L, the discrete operator, by the continuous approximation. So rather than putting this, rather than putting UH, I put this, and rather than putting the discrete derivatives, I put the approximation in terms of continuous derivatives this way. So we have this problem is equivalent to this problem reinterpreted. And now what we see is that we don't have a single problem, we have a series of problems, because if this is going to be equal to 0 for arbitrary values of h, it has to be the case that order by order, we're going to have to get a 0. So at 0th order, we just have that, which is the problem we're going to solve for. So that's the concept. This has to be required by consistency. And let's see what we have at the next order, which is now we pick the h squared term, and we see what we get. And this is what we get. It tells us that the leading function of our error, this e2, which is what is multiplying h squared, what I call g over there, obeys this equation that says, again, an advection equation for e2 has a source now that is given by the derivatives, third derivative, higher derivatives of u. So that's telling us that the error is sourced by the zeroth order part of the solution, which is what we want, and it will have a mind of its own. And depending on how this behaves, what equation we're inducing for that error, we may have something that blows up, behaves well or not. For this particular case, again, the solution is very simple. We already solved for u, and we have a solution for u. We can actually solve explicitly what the equation for e2 is, subject to, say, the initial condition that there should be no error. We're specifying our initial configuration. Let's assume that has no error. When we solve for E2, what we find is that E2 has something that is periodic multiplied by T. So this is telling us that if we try to use this system, this approximation, for a very, very long time, our error will be very large. Because what we have in here is that function G, which I'm calling E2 there, is something that grows linearly with time. And generically, we're going to have any possible behavior, unless we're very careful, we could have things that actually behave in much worse terms, like exponential blowups, etc. So this is just an example that tries to stress the fact that when we solve the finite difference problem, we thought we're simplifying our life by changing one continuous problem into a discrete problem. But in reality, what's going on in the background is we're solving an infinite number of finite difference approximation problems that can be reinterpreted from the continuum manner. We have to be mindful of that to understand what the behavior might be of our solution. Okay, so let me just discuss a little bit of convergence tests. So short of being able to do what we just discussed, in general, which is the general case, we can do experiments to inform us very well of what's going on. So one obvious case is to say, well, you have a code, you can produce a solution. Well, work on that with that solution in different ways to understand what how things are going on. So one of them is the following. Suppose you have a given configuration for some given initial data, some given boundary conditions, and you pick some spacing H. Obtain the solution at any given time that you care. Now go to the same code. Now improve your resolution by some given factor, or this is actually going in the opposite direction. The spacing is 2H. So let me just kind of backtrack. Suppose this was the first one. You have some initial spacing 4H. Now rerun your solution, obtain it again, but now with the spacing that is half the first one. And then do it again, which is half of the previous one. So you have three different solutions. So pictorially, what you have obtained is something first. Oh, no, let me do it this way. On a grid that has points here, then you obtain another one in grids that have points here. And finally, you have another one that has points here. So we mentioned if our code is convergent, it better be that the error associated with the finest grid is smaller than the one in the coarser grid. The important thing is of using U2H, 2H, and 4H is that every 4 points, we have a solution in all 3 cases. Right? So here, we cannot compare this value with anyone else because we don't have that. But here, 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 and there, we have the 3 different solutions that we obtained coincided at particular spatial points. And because of that, we can compare how they behave. And again, in the lab today, we'll see that explicitly. So what does that buy us? Well, it buys us a lot. So the very first thing we can do with it is just notice that we have these 3 cases, these 3 solutions, using the Richardson observation. Given that U, the discrete value, should be expressible in terms of continuous functions, the only thing that changes in the right-hand side is that these H's get multiplied by 2 or 4. But now consider taking the difference of this minus that, taking a norm, and typically the L2 norm, so you just add the values of the functions or whatever you have, square at every given point, add them all up, and divide by the number of points, and take the square root. You can do this difference divided by that difference. And what you notice, and you can convince yourself very easily, that this factor for a code that is, say, second order accurate, and this is what we're thinking because the leading part of the error goes like h squared, this should give us 4. So testing that indeed this value is 4 is a very useful way that to check that your code is convergent, and moreover, is convergent to the scheme, to the order of the scheme that you implemented. But we can do something else, and here it is a typo. This should be square here and 2h squared there. The other thing we can do is the following. So notice here that just pick this solution, u2h. The error of u2h is governed by this piece. But given that this e2 should be the same in all cases, we can always combine two of them to just get rid of the E2 piece and therefore have something that has goes like H to the fourth. So let me just illustrate that here. If we were to consider this combination, this is a new discrete function that we are obtaining out of the other discrete functions. I take the UH and the U2H, but I multiply the first one by 4 and divide the whole thing by 3. Once we replace what we had for one and what we have for the other one, we chose the value 4 so that the 4 times that one cancels this 4h squared here. So as a result, we have something that the error that has an error given by here there is a typo because it should be 4u minus u is the 3 divided by 3. So here's u tilde h is uh minus 4h to the 4th. So we just did, we obtained the solution just twice, which was second order. And by just combining them in a particular way, all of a sudden we have something that is fourth order. And of course, nothing stops us from keep going at it and just eliminate the next order and so on. Okay, I want to say a few more things and then wrap. Okay, so this is something that will tell you your code is convergent. If it converges to the order that you work hard to get, that's also a very good sign. But how would you know that you didn't make that mistake? So if you make a mistake like this, this test will not tell you. Because you just change the problem. It's also similar to the one you were trying to solve, but you can't. So there is something, here are some words, you can take a look at them at the notes, but let me just kind of summarize what it is. Suppose someone hands you a solution, just as you would analytically. Suppose they write a line element, a metric, and they say, this is a solution of Einstein's equations, and you don't trust me because you know me and I'm kind of sloppy, and you say, I want to check. The first thing you will do is just grab, say, Mathematica or Maple. You evaluate the Ricci, and it better be zero if I told you it would correspond to a vacuum solution. Here it would be exactly the same. Someone gives you a discrete solution, and it tells you it's solving this equation. Then you ask no more. You say, well, I don't care to know what particular discretization you use. I will test it on my own. Tell me at least what is the order of convergence. So I tell you it's UH and it converges as H to the P, I tell you what that P is. So then you go on your own and you write a completely independent, because you don't know what I've done, a completely independent LH. And I put a twiddle here because it's yours. You put UH here and see if this actually behaves as H to the P. If that's the case, then you'll be convinced, perhaps, that what I'm giving you is the right solution. So the chances of you and I making exactly the same mistake should be rare. So, and the great thing about this one is, as we'll discuss later, once I'm trying to evolve this equation, I have to be very, very careful on making sure things are stable. But if you're just trying to evaluate things, you're not going to be evolving it. You're just taking at some point and then evaluating this. So you could put something that, if you were to try to evolve using that scheme, you'd get crap, because the errors would accumulate and just blow up exponentially. But you're just going to evaluate it at discrete levels, and you're never actually evolving with that. So as long as you have a consistent approximation for L with a given order, you can always put in the solution and see if this minus the source, H, goes like H to the P. Of course, if you are the one doing your code, you want to kind of do a blind test yourself, and you'll do the same. So you wrote a discretization for L, now forget everything you've done, and come up with purposely a completely different discretization. Again, if you use a Maple script or a mathematical script to get that discretization, don't use it, write it again, because you're worried that you may have introduced bugs like this. But you can always work sufficiently hard to ensure that through a completely independent way, you test that your solution is correct. So this is what is described here. So the last thing I want to say is kind of the stability analysis, which we hinted the RA a little bit. So again, let me consider this prototype example, but in general, I can do this. The concept of stability basically says the size of how big a function might get or a solution might get with time is not wildly different from the initial one. Again, we'll be rigorous next week to what we actually mean by this. In reality, we're going to allow for things to blow up exponentially, but with a criteria for how would be the upper bound and how it could blow up. But for the moment, let's just take this as a possible argument for stability. We're going to imagine that we're always measuring things with respect to some norm. And this sometimes is known in mathematical literature as the energy of the solution, even though it might have nothing to do with the energy that physicists will use. And we want to do kind of get a heuristic argument for what the stability would be. So let's say, again, imagine that we are solving things with the leapfrog method, which we just discussed can grow linearly in time, but let's for the moment just keep thinking that we use that. Something that will be very convenient to us is to see if we can relate the size of the function at any given level n to the size of the function at level n minus 1, and so on. So what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce another variable, because here I have level n plus 1, n, and level n minus 1. So I want to simplify things. And for that, I'm going to assume that I'm going to introduce another variable. Let me introduce this variable v sub n, which is simply what the value of u was at the previous level. So by introducing this, I can write that the update for u and v is nothing more than the following. But when I did that, notice that I only have level sends to the right and the right-hand sides. So I can formally think that now my solution u, which in this case is a vector that has u and v, at the level n plus 1 is given by g at the level un. But now, of course, un is g at the level un minus 1, and so on. So I can have all these compounded. And this is where we're going to use next week the fact that almost all hyperbolic problems can be, in a sense, determined by equations that look like that. But for the moment, we're going to take this as an assumption. Once we have that previous expression, un given by g acting on un minus 1, we can keep acting, and then what we see is that this is what we would end up formally. The nth level of u is given by g, this operator, nth time acting on u0. And the next thing we can do is that if this g can be diagonalized, and generically we'll argue that we will be able to do that, then we can write this in terms of a diagonal form, because it's an operator. Remember, we started with a continuum problem. When we do a discrete representation, we end up with an algebraic problem. And that algebraic problem now is governed by this matrix. We're assuming that we can diagonalize it. And if we can diagonalize it, then this will be just the diagonal matrix with every single eigenvalue to the n power. And so then it would be true that the value of the function at the level n is going to be essentially given by some coefficients, the eigenvalues to the nth power, and some vectors. Again, this we'll look at in much more details next week. So our goal now is to argue the following. So roughly what we are arguing is that un is going to be something that has some vector here, but more importantly, has the eigenvalues, well, let me call it lambda k, to the nth power. In this picture, what we're thinking is that we started at t equals 0, and we go to t equal t after n steps. But then suppose you do another run, and you take an h that is half of the size that I use. That means you're going to have twice as many steps to go from this time to that time, right? Which now means that this n power that we have in here will go to 2n. So we can come up with a very simple criteria of stability that says the maximum value of lambda k better be less or equal to 1. Because if it is greater than 1, then it's going to be very sensitive as to how many steps we take to go from 0 to some given time. And that it would also tell us that as we decrease our grid size, we make it finer and finer, which then will mean we take more and more steps, the solution will get larger and larger. So that's always a sign of instability. Every time we're hoping we're doing a discrete representation of the solution that is governed by the size of the order grid. We always have in our mind that we can take the limit of that h going to zero and we should get the analytical solution. And now what we're seeing is that if one of these eigenvalues happen to be larger than one, we're not going to be able to achieve that. If we reduce the size of our grid, it actually will blow up proportional to how big the grid is. So that's typically, that will be the sign of instability. And this is related, as we'll discuss later, to this lambda we introduce. It will turn out, remember we said delta t is lambda delta x. It will turn out that depending on the problems we're working, no matter what we do, we're always going to have a lambda that is greater than 1, and then we should throw it away. But in our cases, we'll see that if by adjusting the size of lambda, we're always going to bring everything to satisfy this criteria. And this we'll discuss later on. Yeah, and this argument has to do with this current, the CFL instability. So typically, these lambdas will have to be of order 1 or smaller. There will be always an upper limit. But again, we'll discuss this. And depending on which scheme you use, these lambdas will be different. So you might have heard of Runge-Kutta methods or Runge-Kutta's second, third, or fourth order have definitely different values of lambda. Also, if you have a completely implicit limit, there will be cases where, for instance, if you're doing implicit schemes, lambda will have no bound. No matter what value of lambda you use, it will always be stable for the right problem. And there are problems that no matter what lambda, however small you choose lambda, it will always be unstable. So these are the things that one has to be very careful with when choosing a scheme. But again, we're just trying to do the basic first tools to begin to work forward, and then as we go along, we'll learn some more. So I'll stop here. And tomorrow we're actually going to be coming back and beginning to study Einstein's equations themselves. But for the moment, we wanted to get you up to speed so as to be able to tackle the first lab. So we'll meet again at what time?
At 2 o'clock.
At 2 o'clock in the Sky Room. And I'll tell you a little bit about this software that we have and how useful that software is because many of these tests that we discuss are essentially built in automatically in those codes. Okay. Stop.